Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the show. Great to see everyone. Or if you're listening, of course, lots of you listen to the show on the podcast, which we're delighted about. Before we start, just so you know, I do have COVID-19. Unfortunately, I was tested positive yesterday. I'll talk a little bit about that a bit later on, because we are very lucky to be joined by the Emeritus Professor Robert West. That I just mispronounced the first part of that. We'll talk about that as well. But we'll be talking about the situation with the pandemic. I am feeling a bit wiped out, but I'm feeling much better than I did yesterday. But I'll talk about that, as I've said, in a bit. But obviously, if I was feeling too ill, I would not be doing the show. So my first shot has almost certainly helped. And I will talk about that as well, because there's certain anti-vaxxers who have jumped on this as per... with their total unhinged nonsense. But I am doing fine. As you can see, I've got my water. I'm going to stay hydrated. I'm obviously self-isolating for 10 days from when the symptoms began last week. But I'll talk about my own particular circumstances, just because it's important when this happens to use your platform to make sure you don't inadvertently fuel people undermine confidence in our brilliant mass vaccination program, which we should be very proud of. But we will talk about that in about 10 or 15 minutes. But first, before I bring in the brilliant Dawn Butler, and we're very lucky to have Dawn Butler, who is, of course, the star of the moment, having been kicked out of Parliament for the heinous, outrageous, despicable crime of objectively stating an objective, incontrovertible fact that Boris Johnson lies. He doesn't lie once or twice, doesn't lie just occasionally just to spruce things up. He lies as a central element of his entire governing philosophy. And what Dunn did is read out some very striking examples of those lies. And as a consequence, she was kicked out for breaking parliamentary convention, because we live in a country where to call out Tory lies is to be held to account, whilst those who are responsible for those lies get away with it. The only people held to account for conservative lies in this country are literally the people calling them out. So we will, I'm about to bring her in. Just not quick housekeeping. If you're watching this, obviously, on video, click through to YouTube. That just helps support the show. So just click the YouTube link. To support all the work we do in the brilliant team and the documentaries that we're going to make. We are doing a documentary about who owns Britain. It's been slightly delayed because I've got COVID-19 and I can't leave the house. But we will be able to do that thanks to your support with our brilliant team on union, being paid union money because of your support on patreon.com/OwenJones84. If you give £3 or whatever, that all helps us to do those, I think, documentaries we're very proud of, as well as the podcast, as well as all the interviews that we do and the whole operation. And you can also support us using if you want to put questions to our guests, using Super Chat, but you can only do that on YouTube. So click through to that. That supports the show as well. Like John McKenzie, who is a regular who's based in Hong Kong. I will read out everybody who's used Super Chat at the end and give you all a very special thanks. Do click like on YouTube and subscribe. Because that helps other people. If you press like, watch the video, and also do listen to the podcast. If you're not listening to the podcast, then just subscribe. Right. With all that said and done, let's just bring in the brilliant Dawn Butler, who we are very, very lucky to have. Hey, Dawn, how you doing? Hey.
Morning, Irene. Sorry you've got COVID. Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Not too bad.
What can you do, eh? You had COVID, didn't you?
No, I didn't. Thank goodness. I haven't. I was ill, but it wasn't COVID, yeah. So I didn't get my antibodies until I got my jabs.
Oh, right. Okay, so you're fully jabs. You can't get COVID, obviously, just to clarify everybody, through through YouTube. So she's not at risk. So Dawn, what we're going to do, we're just going to put a little clip up of you very courageously and honourably doing the right thing, which is calling out the Prime Minister's lies in Parliament and then facing the consequences.
Prime Minister said the economy has grown by 73%. It's just not true. Reinstating nurses' bursary, just not true. There wasn't an app working anywhere in the world, just wasn't true. Tories invested $34 billion in the NHS, not true. The Prime Minister said we have severed the link between infection and serious disease and death. Not only is this not true, Madam Deputy Speaker, but it is dangerous, and it's dangerous to line the pandemic. And I'm disappointed that the Prime Minister has not come to the House to correct the record and to correct the fact that he has lied to this House and the country over and over again.
Order. I'm sure that the member will reflect on her words. She's saying perhaps correct the record.
Madam Deputy Speaker, what would you rather, a weakened leg or a severed leg? You know, at the end of the day, the Prime Minister has lied to this House time and time again. And it's funny that we get in trouble in this place for calling out the lie rather than the person lying.
Order, 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 order. Can you please reflect on your words and withdraw your remarks?
Deputy Speaker, I've reflected on my words, and somebody needs to tell the truth in this House that the Prime Minister has lied.
Under the power given me by Standing Order number 43, I order the member to withdraw immediately from the House for the remainder of the...
Incredible stuff. I mean, I have to say that the problem is, we've had the very brilliant principal journalist Peter Oborne on the channel before, and he's literally written a book which is kind of that thick about the lies of Boris Johnson. The only thing is, you basically got through about 0.001% of the lies. But that point you made in that brilliant, brilliant speech, which you suffered the consequences for, that point about you, that people, that you're being held to account because you called out the Prime Minister's lies, that obviously the Prime Minister doesn't suffer any consequences. What does that tell us about our country and our politics?
Exactly. I mean, we are living in this Alice in Wonderland, you know, topsy-turvy world where the Prime Minister can say absolutely what he wants, know that it's a lie, because most of the times he knows it's a lie. Sometimes he might not, but most of the times he knows it's a lie and he gets away with it. And the thing is that they've been doing this for the last 18 months, and they've been using the pandemic as a screen to hide their authoritarian ways of dealing with our democracy. So they're trying to chip away and remove the very core of our country, and that is our democracy. So the Prime Minister can lie. That's okay. I can't say he's a liar because that's unparliamentary. He doesn't care about Parliament and he doesn't care about parliamentary rules. None of the ministers do. There was a time when if you were a minister and you were found to have been bullying civil servant, you would apologise or you would resign your position as that minister. The Prime Minister says, no, it's fine. Priti Patel can go on. It's fine. We'll just pay off the civil servant. Matt Hancock was caught literally with his pants down, breaking the rules. Now, that would be a resigning offence under any other government, not under Boris Johnson's government, because the truth doesn't matter. And so we have to call this out. You know, the Coronavirus 2020 Act, I've done a lot of work on that in terms of there are powers on the statute book that should make everybody's eyes water. You know, if you are suspected of having COVID, you can be arrested, right? Now, you have COVID, I mean, you're at home, but anybody could be suspected of having COVID because it's asymptomatic. So this government could literally say, oh, I think you've got COVID, send the police to arrest you. That is actually on the statute book. I'm not making any of this stuff up. So in every avenue you turn to say, okay, let me tell you what, we can protest about it. Well, the government has tried to put on the statute books that you can't protest if you're too noisy. What? This is crazy. I had had enough. You know, the week started with learning about these Tory MPs who tried to pervert the course of justice by influencing a judge and a sexual assault case, and three of those MPs' punishment was to be banned from Parliament for the day. I was like, what? This is, I think, what is happening to our country? You know, what is actually happening to our country and our democracy? And I just, you know, had enough, really.
I mean, this is a slightly depressing thing to say, but do you think the problem we've now got is, look, I mean, Boris Johnson himself, before he was prime minister, was already a proven serial liar. He was sacked by his party leader as a shadow minister for lying. He was sacked by his newspaper editor for lying. He falsified a quote, which is one of the worst things you can do in journalism. And if he wasn't someone from an extremely privileged background, he would have undoubtedly been thrown out of the media industry, but he wasn't. He was allowed to continue falling upwards. But isn't the problem we've got now is that this prime minister and his party, aided and abetted by most of the press in this country, who have a very partisan support of the Conservative Party, have just normalised lying to such an extent that there is no penalty. That, in a sense, they just, you know, they've, you know, it's got so far that it doesn't matter if they lie anymore, because they know there is no consequence.
Absolutely. And that's what they're relying on. So they rely on the rest of us to be honourable and to abide by the rules. And all the time, they are taking the piss behind our backs. You know, they, and this is also why we have to highlight the fact that when you allow somebody with that much privilege to fail upwards constantly, for there to be no consequences, when you allow a group of elitist classes, individuals to run our country, it means that the country becomes devoid of democracy, so they have more control. But it also means that those people in control can be as corrupt as they like, and nobody's going to hold them to account. And all of the legacy media made us believe that people don't care. They don't care if Boris lies, because it's baked in to Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister. So Johnson, the Prime Minister, is okay. He always lies. So we know that, but he's all right. He's a good laugh. He's a bit of fun. So it's all baked in. So it's okay. And I think what happened, which also surprised me, that people were feeling this way so strongly, that they were tired of having to follow the rules that the Prime Minister and the few elitists, classes, corrupt ministers at the top don't, was that they've had enough too. And it made me realize how important it is that we have now different media platforms, yourself, Byline TV, Byline News, Navarra Media, Double Down News. You know, it highlighted to me how important it was that the Good Law Project, the work that they've done, they deserve a medal. You know, they have taken this government to court. This government has been found wanted. This government has been found that they lied about contracts being in the public domain. There were 100 contracts that were not in the public domain when the Prime Minister stood up in Parliament and said, oh, don't worry, all the contracts in the public domain, if people want to see it, they can have a look at it. There were 100 that were not in the public domain. You know, the Good Law Project have highlighted, they've got, I think, something like, oh, is it? I can't remember, but lots more cases to come. And what's the government doing? The irony of this, they're spending our public money defending the indefensible. So we're paying for them to defend their lies. They're paying, you know, they spent more money defending the fact that they gave a contract to people who were not qualified than what the contract was worth. It's unbelievable. It's absolutely unbelievable.
And you absolutely, I mean, Good Law Project, Julian Moore and his team, absolute heroes for what?
Phenomenal. Open Democracy. There are so many, or Amnesty, Liberty. There's so many good people in this country just working hard. And I think when the history books are written, you will see all of these organizations where they will say, we tried to tell you this is where we were going and we tried to stop it. And, you know, I want to be part of the good side that said, look, I tried to highlight it and I tried to stop it by using my platform and, you know, in the best way that I could.
I mean, I've got a couple of other questions about that and about you and the chord you've struck. I mean, before I do, the other, you know, there was another, I suppose, huge cut. You've had several huge cut through moments which have really roused people, I think. But one of them was, it was last March when on national television, you again said the objective fact about Boris Johnson and his racism. You were on a panel debate with the MP, Laura Trott, who was outraged. How could you? This is outrageous. Because again, we live in a country where calling out racism is seen as a more heinous crime than racism itself. Boris Johnson, of course, calling black people pickaninnies with watermelon smiles, comparing Muslim women to bank robbers and letterboxes, which caused a big spike in Islamophobic crimes on the streets. Gay people called bum boys and so on. All sorts of tank top bum boys, sorry. Yeah, I mean, I do sometimes wear, you know, on a Saturday. I am a tank top bum boy. But I mean, again, what does that, again, that's just become, I mean, we've seen it recently with the racism that our English, the heroes of the English team, national football team, were subjected to when the government refused to condemn the booing of the English national team, and that legitimized the racism they got. But again, so few, there's people like you holding them to account, but that they're being allowed, it's being legitimized.
Absolutely. And deliberately so. So they've watched Trump and they've decided that this is the way we can win elections. Let's stir up some trouble. Let's have this kind of fake culture war, which the right use, extreme right uses all the time. You know, let's have a war on woke. You know, let's do all of this stuff and let's start creating an environment where you pitch people against each other, you know, those of us that are fighting, you know, society, fighting for our democracy. And let's just, the elite few at the very top, the one percenters, let's us just take all of this wealth for ourselves and keep it for ourselves. And it's a deliberate ploy. And that's why we have to stop. That's why we have to stop him. And I, you know, I think people in the UK are more intelligent and more together and more united than this government thinks that they are. And I've always felt this. And so that's why I'm really pleased at the response, because I'm like, great. I knew that, I knew this was so, I knew it just wasn't in Brent where we would stand up for each other, that it goes far and wide. And that panel that I was on, I was being attacked from all angles, all corners. It was just sort of just me. And it's like, Boris Johnson is not a racist. What? His language was racist? No, it was just unfortunate. It's not unfortunate. It was racist. So Dawn, what you're saying is that you're better than everybody else. Well, no, not what I'm saying is I'm not racist. You know what I mean? That's what I'm saying. And Boris Johnson is, you know, with his language. So, you know, it was being attacked, and that's what they do. You know, when you stand up, you get attacked, and then you're supposed to just cower, used in the right term, Secretary of State for Health, you're supposed to just cower and let them attack you instead of standing in your power and saying, well, actually, I know I'm right. And so, yeah, this government is corrupt and it's divisive and it's led by a liar, and the fish rots from the head, and we have a rotten government.
Just a couple of other quick things, because I know how phenomenally busy you are at the moment, but in terms of the response you get, I'm interested to hear, because online it's gone wild, absolutely wild. So I'm interested, partly I'd like to know, have other Labour MPs, what have they said privately? Because there's not been much public response, I have to say. Angela Rayner did allude to what happened by saying that that wherever he's called out, Boris Johnson is a liar. But I'm interested in the response from Labour MPs. But also, what does it say, that public response? Because I'll put this to you, Dawn, I'll just say it bluntly. A lot of people don't think the Labour leadership is offering a proper opposition at the moment to the Conservative Party. So people at the moment, whenever they see just someone being able to stick it to the Tories, they're like, thank goodness, it's like coming up for water. That's how people feel. They're like, someone's got the guts and the courage to do this, you know? And that's partly it. Do you not think, so I'm interested what Labour MPs do you think are thinking about it, but isn't it the case that a lot of people looked at what you did and thought, finally, there's someone in the Labour Party, he's got some guts, he's going to stick it to the Tories, and that's what the Labour leadership's failing to do?
Well, I feel everybody's frustration, because I too am frustrated. And I mean, being a backbencher is so liberating. So, you know, I have been liberated to do what I like, when I like, and how I like. And I am team Labour through and through. And I believe that we should be fighting for a Labour government. But we do that by outlining what a Labour government would do, what we would look like, how it would affect people's lives. And we do that also by calling out this corrupt, racist, enabling government. And it's frustrating that there's a lot of sort of niceties around, or, you know, we are not a unity government. We are Her Majesty's official opposition. And this government needs to be held to account. It has been 19 months. In the first 2 months, fine. You can give the government leeway. It was a very difficult time. Nobody knew what was coming next. But I sit on the Science and Technology Committee, and I can tell you that from our very first meeting about COVID and the pandemic, and watching the government's press conferences, I knew they were not being straight with the people of our country. I knew it. I knew it not because I'm super clever. I knew it because I was listening to the scientists and I was reading papers and documents. And I'm thinking, hang on a minute, if I'm reading this information from WHO, from the scientists, and I'm gleaning this information, why ain't you? And you've got a whole load of people working for you, and it's just me sitting in my front room, you know, reading it late into the night, thinking, all right, okay, that's what's going to happen next. That's what's going to happen next. So why isn't the government being honest about it? And I think, I think it's very clear that they had other plans and other roads to travel, let's say, you know. And I think the corruption that's been highlighted by the Good Law Project tells you everything you need to know about this government.
Last question. Now, you're probably going to hate me for this, but I don't care. I can read through the comments on both Facebook and YouTube as people are watching this. And it is literally full of people going, basically, I wish Dawn was leader of the Labour Party. Now, I know there's not a vacancy, so you can take that one away. I'm just wondering, would you ever, maybe one day, the idea of being leader of the Labour Party, is that ever something that maybe could it be? All I'm saying is a lot of people are saying it. It's literally, if I hadn't have asked you, then I would be failing in my job and there'd be some sort of riot on YouTube and Facebook, because it is literally loads. I was very proud to vote for you myself as the deputy leader. But I mean, what do you think? Would you ever consider being leader of the Labour Party? What's your thoughts on that?
So, I mean, when I stood to be deputy leader, I stood because I wanted to change how the party, continue as we were in terms of communicating with members. I wanted to grow the party. I wanted us to have life and energy, and I wanted to be a part of that. And I felt I could do that, you know, as deputy leader. I have no intention of standing for leader of the Labour Party. I don't have the patience to deal with all the bullshit, to be quite frank. I just want the party to be better. Do you know what I mean? I want us to be better as a Labour Party. I want us to, you know, every time the Conservatives say the vaccine rollout has done really well and we should be applauded for that, I'm like, well, the NHS is a socialist endeavour. You know, the Tories voted against it because they didn't want it, because it was socialism in plain sight. So what you're saying is socialism delivered a really good vaccine rollout. Yay. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about it in a terms that people can understand that what we've done as a Labour Party and when we were in government is stuff that has stood the test of time and has been good for our country. And we can do that again if we get into power.
Very diplomatic answer. lots of people already coming up with the slogans, A New Dawn. I mean, they write themselves, really, to be honest with you. We'll revisit it maybe some other time. But seriously, Dawn, it's been a massive, massive pleasure. You do have a massive army of fans. And people, again, as I said, saw someone who stood up and said what needed to be said, got gaslit, essentially, by parliamentary procedure. But the Prime Minister is a liar. He's a proven liar. He lies, as we've said, as a basic instrument of political rule and governance in this country, as does his party, facilitated by much of the media. You called them out and you suffered the consequences because that's the country we live in. But it won't be. We'll one day get justice and we will be able to speak the truth. And those like yourself who stood up against Tory lies, I think, will be remembered for doing the right thing, regardless of the cost. So thank you so, so much, Dawn. And look after yourself and I'll speak to you soon.
Thanks, Owen. You too. Take care.
Take care. All right. Brilliant stuff. That's what we want. Now, I'm going to bring in the... I mean, she is brilliant, isn't she? I'm going to bring in now the... And I'm going to keep mispronouncing his title. It's really annoying because we rehearsed it before. Emeritus Professor Robert West. Robert, please correct me. I'm really sorry. I can't pronounce it. I did try. Before, didn't I?
Emeritus.
Now, Robert West is one of our leading COVID experts, and many of you will be familiar with his work. So we're very, very lucky to have you. So thank you so, so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
I'll just say quickly about my... I think it's important that I just mention my circumstances, because you don't... I don't really... And I'll say it, and then if I get anything wrong as well, that's what's important, because I know I've seen predictably some anti-vaxxer people going, oh, you've been double jabbed and you've got COVID. So just so everyone is aware, I got my first Moderna shot on the 23rd of May. I got my second Moderna shot on Tuesday. A second shot, of course, takes 2 weeks, generally speaking, to be effective. But I was actually, I mean, I know when I was infected. I was infected a day and a half or so earlier than my second shot. In any case, I started to feel, I felt a bit rough, a dead arm after my second shot. I actually felt the same after my first shot. Started to feel better, but then I started getting hit by symptoms again. I was a bit like, you know, obviously I've got some weird delayed symptoms. I felt wiped out and so on. By yesterday, you know, those symptoms were getting worse. I felt really wiped out yesterday. I had a slight cough, which had begun to emerge. I did a lateral flow test. It was positive. Lateral flow tests aren't always completely reliable. So I did, in fact, they're not. So don't rely on them. So I did a PCR test and I am indeed positive with COVID-19. Today, I actually feel significantly better than yesterday. Fingers crossed. Over the last 3 days, I have felt worse in the afternoon into the evening. We'll see how that goes. My sleep last night was weird, very weird dreams. I had smallpox anyway. But the point is, and this is what is important for people to know, the first shot of EG Moderna, which is what I have, which is an mRNA vaccine like the Pfizer jab, it gives some protection against symptomatic illness, but limited. And it gives greater, with caveats, coverage against serious illness, hospitalization, and death. A second shot plus 2 weeks, which is not me until I'm afraid a week on Tuesday, that provides much higher protection, but not absolute, against symptomatic illness, and also even higher protection, particularly for those who are vulnerable, underlying conditions, who are older, against serious illness, hospitalization, death. We know that because cases are off the charts at the moment, and as you can see, I am struggling to get from... that's the main problem I have, brain fog at the moment. What was I saying? Yeah, so you get, with a second shot plus 2 weeks, much higher coverage. The whole point about a vaccine, and we're very lucky with these vaccines, is that they have, after two shots in particular, including against Delta, very high levels of protection. But even then, it's not absolute. And you could, in theory, you're still at risk, particularly if you're vulnerable and have underlying health conditions of serious illness, but it's just much lower. So is that Robert? There we go. Sorry, I just thought I should get out my own situation. But have I got that roughly right? And is there anything kind of you'd add to that, I suppose?
Yeah, I mean, you have. And bear in mind that the major trials that were done with the vaccines that we have in this country were done on, not even on the Beta variant, but on the one before that. And the Beta variant is more transmissible. The Delta variant is more transmissible still. So what we have with the Delta variant is already a variant that is showing some degree of vaccine escape. And vaccine escape is the thing that we most fear, because if we get a significant vaccine escape with new variants, then we're kind of almost back to square one, and no one wants that. So we'll come back to that because of the issue of variants and what the government's policy is putting at risk, us at risk of more variants of this kind. It's a really important topic. Figures vary, but just to give your viewers a sense of where we are with the sort of figures you were talking about. But with the Delta variant, the prevalent one in the UK at the moment, to my mind, the best evidence, the best estimate is probably around 50% effectiveness at preventing a PCR infection, in other words, a detectable infection, probably around 70% protection against hospitalization, and probably between 80 and 90% protection against death. So it is the case that with the vaccination program, the link between infection and hospitalization and death has been weakened. That is true. But it also gives some protection. And the other thing is that the vaccine does appear, and this is something we didn't know at the beginning, but it does appear to be the case, that it protects other people from getting infected because it reduces transmission. So all in all, if it weren't for the vaccines, we would be absolutely screwed. The vaccines are keeping us in at least the kind of level of functioning as a society that we've got at the moment.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
So, Robert, at the moment, about one in 75 people officially, myself included, have COVID-19. That's obviously, inevitably, we don't know how much, an underestimate, because there aren't, not everyone is testing. There is anecdotal suggestion that at the moment that we know testing has gone down, and there's always the danger that some people aren't testing because of the lack of financial support, not least for people in precarious occupations, the lack of statutory, the lowest statutory sick pay almost in the Western world. And also there are people who are asymptomatic, which is good for them, but not good for other people because they're obviously more likely to spread the illness. That's one of the cruelties of this and other viruses. The point you made last week, and this is what you said, and it's important because obviously you yourself, you're in Sage's behavioral science subgroup. So you're one of, the big wigs of the pandemic, so to speak. But what you said is what we are seeing is a decision by the government to get as many people infected as possible, as quickly as possible, while using the rhetoric about caution as a way of putting the blame on the public for the consequences. It looks like the government judges that the damage to health and healthcare services will be worth the political capital it will gain from this approach. So I suppose that's is basically the government, do you think, as you're saying out there, consciously going for herd immunity, not obviously we want herd immunity by vaccination, but herd immunity by infection, that they, and I suppose to be devil's advocate, is that such a bad thing? I mean, some would say, well, we're going to have to release restrictions sometime. Do you want to do it in the winter? And if you do it then, the NHS, as we know, is going to struggle, not least actually because in the winter, there's lack of community protection now against, for example, influenza, because flu has been so suppressed as it's less infectious than COVID by the measures we've taken against COVID, as well as other respiratory illnesses. Schools will come back then. So is it so bad? And actually, you know, is it you know, in a sense, better now than then?
Hmm. Yeah, well, even, you know, my colleagues Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance have argued, and they claim that there is a scientific basis for this, although other epidemiologists and clinicians dispute that this, if not now, then when argument has some scientific validity. I don't think it does, because I don't think I think it's a false dichotomy. I think that the idea that if we can get loads of people infected now, somehow it's going to be okay in the winter. And there are concerns about other respiratory illnesses, flu and so on, which will emerge more than in previous years in this coming winter. So that is an issue. But I don't think it is an either or. I think there's so many unknowns between now and then, not least of which, and I alluded to this a bit earlier, is the emergency new variants. Now, I'll come back in a minute, if I may, to why I said what I said and what I think the evidence is, and people can judge for themselves whether they agree with me or whether they don't. The issue of new variants is terribly important, because we've already had in this country two seriously damaging new variants. First of all, with what is now called the Alpha variant, and now obviously with the Delta variant, and that's in the space of 18 months. And that's with infection rates quite substantially under control, not through the ideal method, through because they've been using lockdowns to do it, but at least they've managed to keep a bit of a lid on it. If we let 1,000 flowers bloom, the statistical probability of getting another variant which has even greater vaccine escape and even greater potential clinical morbidity and mortality has got to be significant. You know, it's not something you would want voluntarily to take a risk on. And so the idea that in somehow letting the infection run riot now, we're protecting ourselves in the winter, I think is a mistake. But why did I say it? You know, what evidence was I drawing on? Because clearly the government denies it. Although we, as we've heard from Dawn, who I thought, by the way, was absolutely brilliant, and she would get my vote anytime, probably like millions of others, you know. So anyway, but you know, the government is not known for its honesty, and so the fact that it denies that it's pursuing a herd immunity strategy is not really going to cut much ice. So what do I think? Well, participating in SPY-B, the behavioral subgroup of SAGE, we were asked in March to produce a report on how to sustain infection control behaviors to keep a lid on the infection rates once we got to the end of the roadmap, so that we no longer were relying on these legal restrictions. And I helped with that report, and we sent the report in to the Cabinet Office in April. None of this is a secret. The government sat on it for quite a while, and eventually it's been made public. Mm-hmm. That report was the blueprint for how you can safely or relatively safely come out of the restrictions while keeping a lid on infection rates, and it's basically treating COVID like any other risk management scenario, which we're all familiar with. Safety on the roads, for example. What does it involve? It doesn't just involve telling drivers to act responsibly. That would be stupid. It involves a range of things, including the highway code, including things that people have to do, including training people to be safe on the roads, including providing safety measures on the roads, making cars safer and so on. In other words, it's a risk management strategy that everyone, government, businesses, local authorities and individuals can all get involved in, and it has been successful in minimizing reducing the deaths on the road, deaths and injuries on the road. And that's all we were suggesting. You know, there's plenty of experience in that and other areas for what you can do. And have the government done any of it? No. All they have done is to rather belatedly and in a confused and somewhat self-contradictory way say, right, it's over to you to act responsibly. So in that context, you've got to think to yourself, why? You know, why, if you really wanted to suppress infection rates over the summer, why wouldn't you do any of this stuff? Mm-hmm. It's not even that expensive. Why would you just say, right, okay, we're going to let everything go and then tell people to act responsibly? And so my interpretation of that, also bearing in mind the government's track record on this, and bear in mind also that, you know, in the first wave, they clearly had a sense of wanting to at least before they understood how serious it would be, and they couldn't get away with it because of hospitalizations. You know, they wanted to let it rip through the population. They thought they could get away with it. So anyway, to sum it all up, I wrote in The Guardian or somewhere last year that at that stage, the government was treating this public health crisis as though it was a political crisis. And everything that they've done since then confirms that view, that as long as they think politically that they'll be able to get away with this strategy of letting things run rip and so on and blaming the public, they will do it. The only thing that's going to stop them is if the public won't wear it, and I really hope we won't.
It's interesting. I mean, one of the things I've written about before is how kind of over the last generation, since, I suppose, Thatcherism, there's been a deliberate attempt to, you know, after World War II, we had this understanding of poverty and unemployment as collective problems requiring collective solutions. Thatcherism individualized those people. If poverty and unemployment could be better explained as individual behavioral defects, and therefore you slashed away the welfare state because that was only sustaining the bad behavior, incentivizing the bad behavior, and actually people needed a stick rather than a carrot. And that's, you know, how poverty, and to say a similar approach essentially was imposed in the pandemic, which is if things go wrong, it's not because of the government's collective failings and or wider collective failings in society, like the underfunding of the NHS, like the failures of PPE, like the failures of test and trace, but rather these ne'er-do-wells down the road, you know, these people in the parks often using long lens cameras to make it look like people more crammed in than they are. The young who have essentially been a cordon sanitaire to protect older people throughout this pandemic, made huge sacrifices, and then are demonized as somehow being responsible for anything that happens rather than the government itself. I mean, I'm just interested, what, in terms of your subgroup, you're talking about it there, and obviously bear with me, but what comes next in terms of that, you know, what are you advising for the next phase of the pandemic? And linked to that, again, the counter argument people keep making is, it's that point you made about risk, which is, well, look, at the end of the day, you can minimize risk, but you can't eliminate risk, and you have to juggle it with other competing risks. And we know, having had 17 months of some forms of restrictions in this country until last week, that there are huge costs, obviously, in terms of living through restrictions, and people have suffered consequences of them. And eventually those costs become bigger than the potential costs of the pandemic. That's the argument, and that it's about competing risks. So isn't it the case, well, look, COVID now, we've got mass immunization, particularly of vulnerable and older people. We've got to relax restrictions at some point. The risks of COVID-19 have been very sizably reduced. So I suppose with that in mind, what are you advising, and what's your response to those saying,
yeah,
now with COVID are so much lower?
Yeah, I mean, it's just such nonsense. I mean, it would be like saying, oh, well, you know, years gone past, we had loads more deaths on the roads, loads more deaths and serious injuries. And the crashes that people had were massively disruptive to the economy and to people's lives and so on. And we didn't say, well, you know, you've got to get around, haven't you? What can you do? We just got to get on with it. We didn't do that because that would be stupid. What we did was progressively build and improve and develop and improve and develop and improve a safety culture and a risk management strategy on our roads, as we have in work sites, as we have in other areas, so that, yes, living with COVID does not mean cowering to COVID, and it doesn't mean letting COVID run rip through the community, because the damage that COVID will do if allowed to run rip through the community is way greater than anything, you know, that you would that could happen because of a risk management strategy. So the risk management strategy that we proposed, and that if anyone from the government, you know, I'd be surprised if they were listening, but maybe they could hear about it, you know, go and look at what Spy B wrote and have a look and see what you can put in place. That risk management strategy is not disruptive of people's lives. It's about things like getting places properly ventilated. It's about providing proper investment and incentive schemes so that businesses, public spaces and so on can be as safe as they can be. It's about providing effective communication with the public so that they know what they need to do in what situation, when they need to do it, and why they need to do it. It's not hard, but that's the sort of thing. And it's not disruptive. In fact, the disruptive thing, as we're seeing, is that if you just let the virus rip, then you've got hundreds of thousands of people having to isolate. That is causing huge disruption. So then you say, oh, well, let's not make them isolate. You know, let's just see, you know, how we can go, because actually that's more disruptive than letting the virus get rid. Well, good luck with that, because you're not just looking at people who have been sick and hospitalized. You're looking at potential long term. I haven't brought up long COVID, and neither have I brought up the potential longer term cognitive and other complications from COVID. You're taking a massive risk with our economy. For what? For what? All you need to do is to implement a risk management strategy of the kind that we use in other areas. So it seems willful to me, willful not to do that.
Some of our eagle-eyed viewers and listeners have noticed, of course, you referred indirectly to Sajid Javid, the health secretary, who has now deleted his tweet in which he said that we needed to live with the virus, not cower. And he said, I've deleted a tweet which used the word cower. I was expressing gratitude. No, you weren't. That the vaccines help us fight back as a society. But it was a poor choice of word, and I sincerely apologise. Like many, I've lost loved ones to this awful virus and never minimised its impact. I mean, regardless, actually, I mean, he's obviously regrets the backlash it's caused. But actually, it was indicative of the government's approach, which is to let the virus essentially let rip through the population, and to not do so is seen as weak, and we're cowering before that. I mean, it's insulting to those of us, you know, to everyone who's lost relatives in this crisis. In terms of what individuals do to act responsibly, given the circumstances we're in, what would you say?
Well, I also help with Independent Sage, which is complementary to Sage. It was never set up as a in any way in opposition to Sage, but very much complementary to it. And Independent Sage, as you know, and you know, plays a huge role in trying to do the job that we were hoping the government would do about informing the public. And one of the things that we're doing at the moment is taking this Spy B report and then developing a sort of COVID safe code, a bit like the highway code. So okay, if other people aren't going to take their responsibility, if government's not going to take its responsibility seriously, what can you do as an individual? What can we do as individuals to keep ourselves safe as we can, and other people around us? And, you know, there are a number of things, and each one of those requires, you know, a little bit of knowledge and a bit of understanding. But probably the single most important thing is understanding what your risks are, when and where. And what you can do about it. So, for example, given that fewer people now around me in public areas are wearing face masks, I will now be wearing, in situations where I think the risk is higher, an FFP3 or FFP2 mask, but one which gives me a higher level of protection. So if you can do that, then, you know, wearing masks to give yourself more protection in situations which are high risk, which is not walking out on Hampstead Heath, for example. things like obviously maintaining your hand washing and so on, because we mustn't forget that fomite or contact transmission is still probably a thing, although aerosol transmission seems to be most important. Things like judging what events and what things you're going to attend. So my poor, a very good friend of mine who was incredibly careful for, you know, throughout the whole pandemic, let her guard down once and went to a wedding and got COVID. And so recognizing what the level of risk is and what you're going to do, how are you going to act in those situations? There's a lot we can do, and we at Independent Sage, I think, will be providing more advice on that. But it's more than just, you know, in some general sense, acting responsibly. It's about knowing what you need to do when and why.
Just a couple of other things. One, in terms of where are we at, basically, with the pandemic. So if I look at the government's dashboard, COVID positive tests over the last week, it looks superficially like good news, because we've seen a dramatic surge, down by about 4.5%. So yesterday, about 31,795 tested positive. Now, it'd be interesting to see what happens with so-called Freedom Day. I'm one of those statistics. I'm a Freedom Day so-called statistic. As that over the coming days, but also the issue, as I've said, about are lots of people now refusing to get tested. Deaths have gone up, unfortunately, by 57.5%. We're now up to 86 yesterday. So that's clearly markedly gone up from where we were. Still much lower, of course, than where we were in January, where about 2,000 people officially were dying a day. In terms of patients, and of course, this is important because of the NHS and the pressures on the NHS, that in the last week has gone up by over a quarter. So it's nearly 1,000, or to about nearly 917 patients yesterday. And on that as well, I'd be interested to know, it's been said that a lot of those stays are actually shorter stays because people often are vaccinated. So if they are requiring hospitalization, despite being vaccinated, their illness is less severe, and therefore their stay is anyway. What do you think about those general statistics and where?
Yeah, what's going on? So it's a little hard to say, because those statistics you cited about PCR positive or test positive rates having gone down in the last week are surprising and a bit of an anomaly. Infection rates are probably the best measure of infection rates across the home nations is the ONS infection survey. So if any one of your viewers doesn't know about that, then just put ONS infection survey and you'll see. And the reason why that is the best sort of marker of infections is because it's a random sample. It's not reliant on people coming forward and so on. So now that is still going up, and that is still going up rapidly, but that's always a week or so out of date. So we will know probably next week whether this apparent drop that we've got in the PCR tests, the daily stats, is an artifact of fewer people coming forward to be tested, because COVID's become more normalised, and so they're saying, well, and also they're disincentivised from being tested because of the consequences in terms of getting back to work and so on. So it could be that. I mean, the best thing in the world would be if somehow we had got to a stage where we had acquired a sufficient level of immunity through vaccination and past infection to start to bring this down. But I have to say, Sage did not model that. No, none of the epidemiologists that I know have modeled anything like a peak until probably late August or September. So it would be surprising if that drop were real. Maybe it is, and the virus has thrown all sorts of, you know, curveballs at us. But it'd be great if it were. But it seems, you know, quite likely to me that it's an artifact of fewer people getting tested. We'll see.
Just before I ask the final question, just a couple of questions that I've had, just kind of interesting medical questions. One from Tejas Cantwell. One of the things I've heard is evidence points to a longer 6 to 8 week distance between jabs provides better long-term protection from the vaccine. Is that true? And Foxglove asked, do you think the testing of positive cases has gone down because the NHS listed COVID symptoms are out of date for Delta? I'm quite interested in that because actually one of the things I noticed is yesterday I did have a, just so everyone can know, I had a blocked nose. And I didn't, I remember that wasn't initial, that wasn't listed as the original symptoms of COVID-19, which has obviously, I'm afraid to say, changed and transformed. As we know, it's far more infectious, but the symptoms have changed as well. So, you know, are people now, because actually it's quite bewildering because, you know, for people, the signature, you know, people think loss of taste and smell. I don't have that. Fever. I don't actually have a fever. I don't, my temperature's normal, to be honest. In my case, I have basically a slightly blocked nose and a slight respiratory illness, and I feel rough. So, I mean, is that part of the problem that people, you know, with symptoms? So I'm just interested in that and the vaccine, the vaccine gap question.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. I mean, both of them are really good questions. So let's do the second one first. That, you know, that does sound quite plausible, except why would that have just sort of kicked in the last week or so? I'm not sure. I think if that were the case, then that would have, we'd have seen that a bit earlier, you know, once Delta became the dominant variant. So I wouldn't rule it out, but and maybe it's synergistic with other things. Like if you've got, you know, if you haven't got what seem to be the classic symptoms, if you look at the NHS website, which really does need updating, but if you haven't got the classic symptoms and you're disinclined to get a test because of the consequences of that, then maybe those two are working together. It's a bit hard to say. I'd probably doubt it. But the first thing is a really interesting point, and actually, I was talking about this to friend Ranjit. I was playing tennis this morning. And by the way, he came up with a very good phrase for what the leadership of the opposition seem to be doing. And what did he call it? Bystander politics or something.
Love it. Thank you. That'll be in a column.
I mean, because they're not really doing anything. It's basically down to Dawn and, you know, and some, you know, brave souls to pick up the cudgels. But anyway, so going back to the issue of what's the best sort of time between vaccines. So the original idea in the randomized trials set 4 weeks as their figure by and large. What happened with the AstraZeneca trial was that because of some problems with the trial, a significant subsample had to wait 12 weeks. Now, they also only had half dose for the first dose, but those people seemed to do better than the people in the main body of the trial. So I think the government felt it was okay. It would probably be okay. And looking at the immunology and the virology and so on, they thought it was a risk worth taking to extend it from 4 weeks to 12 weeks. But it was always going to be 4 weeks. That was the idea. Now, since then, we don't, you know, we've got observational evidence, not terrifically good randomized controlled trial evidence on the optimal dose. But I mean, the long and the short of it is that we don't really know. I mean, 4 weeks worked pretty well in the randomized trials. We think it's not too damaging to go a bit further with the mRNA vaccines. With the AstraZeneca vaccine, it seems to be perfectly fine to go to 12 weeks. But if, you know, I think if someone said to me, you've got to have it at 4 weeks, you've got to have it at 6 weeks, you've got to have it at 12 weeks, I'd probably have it earlier rather than later because you get the second dose in earlier. But I don't think there's a lot in it.
Just finally, the risk posed by anti-vax and anti-lockdown, what are they protesting about? There's no lockdown anyway. I've certainly been, I can see my own mentions. I keep getting, we're dealing, people are saying, obviously on YouTube, we have anti-vaxxers, just so everyone knows, we are blocking them. Sorry, we have to we try not to block people unless, you know, one of our tests is if they're anti-vaxxers because they are spreading dangerous and objectively untrue misinformation. But just to give you, you know, yesterday on Saturday, that is, they are very disturbing speeches at a rally. It included the former nurse, Kate Shemirani, who has been struck off in June. She said COVID vaccines are satanic, citing the pattern 060606. A former Brexit politician, a former London Assembly member, David Curtin, saying they're not vaccines, experimental injections. MPs are doing the bidding of evil. Some wacky German lawyer. These vaccinations are experimental gene therapies. 500,000 being killed by them in the US. That anti-5G activists were there. The virus is a hoax. This is domestic terrorism and genocide. Katie Hopkins was predictably there, telling people to rub themselves up against each other. David Icke's son saying, talking about the Great Reset stuff, which has become one of their signature lines. A former GP, obviously, shouldn't be taken seriously. Vernon Coleman, manufactured fake COVID-19 is just the flu rebranded. Piers Corbyn, unfortunately, was also there. You're much more likely to die, get ill from the jab than you are from COVID. I mean, obviously, I should say this is all nonsense, and I'm just giving. David Icke was there. Demons have persuaded millions to believe in their plan in global tyranny. Quite disturbing speeches, but including Kate, the nurse, former nurse, not a nurse anymore, Kate Shemirani, who spoke about the Nuremberg trials, in which doctors and nurses who'd been accomplices, obviously, of Nazi tyranny, were hanged, and said that doctors and nurses should get off the bus now. Very menacing stuff, indeed, whipping up murderous hatred against the people who carried this country through its darkest hours since World War II. Mm. I mean, how serious is this? Because we know the polling shows actually anti-vax sentiment in Britain is actually very low compared to other countries, but it's still there. I mean, how serious is it? They're very vocal, obviously, online. They're vocal when they do their protests. And you can see often what happens, like any conspiracy theorists. They prey on vulnerable people online who've gone through a very difficult time, as the country has, people in different ways. And they prey on that with misinformation, and people go down rabbit holes. I mean, how serious do you think it is? How worried should we be about it at this stage?
I think it's a significant issue. As you rightly say, it's far less of an issue in this country than it is in some other countries, and you know, thank goodness for that. I think that the people themselves, and obviously they get platforms now to, you know, to propagate their views, have potentially a direct damaging effect, which is probably intended, on the morale of people who are trying to do their very best to, you know, to keep the country safe and to treat people. And, you know, it is heartbreaking to see doctors and nurses, clinicians, people working in the health service of all kinds, who are distressed when they see this kind of attack. And my message to them is don't be distressed. I mean, because these people, don't waste your emotional energy on these people. Just bear in mind that, you know, how many of these people, anti-vaxxers, have up till the current moment been rational, normal sort of people who evaluate evidence and speak in, you know, reasonable terms in in their conversations about things. How many of them actually were like that? And then because they've analysed the situation with regard to vaccines and COVID in a very careful way, looking at all the pros and cons, they've come to the view that vaccines are dangerous and so on. The answer is probably very few, if any. What you have always is a group of people who have a proclivity to take this particular stance for whatever reason, and thankfully there's not many of them. But the other risk, I think, and I have seen this, is that not through what they say, because, you know, people know that they're not ready to be trusted, but someone then repeats something, and then someone repeats that, and you get some of this message sort of filtering through to People who aren't anti-vaxxers and who are just wanting to find, you know, make judgments, make decisions in a highly complex scenario, and that they are affected, and that's a larger group of people. And I think this again is where the government had to do and has to do a lot more to counter these arguments by being open, honest, transparent, not glossing over the dangers and the risks and all the side effects and things like that, but by saying the risk benefit analysis is this, this is what we think, it's your choice. And I think if you treat people in that way, then fewer people are going to be taken in by this sort of small group of people who spread these misinformation.
And I should be clear, because it's come up in the comments, when I said the anti-5G activist Mark Steele, I don't mean the brilliant comedian Mark Steele, who definitely is not a conspiracy theorist. He's a brilliant guy. It's Mark Steele spelled with an E at the end as well. So just to be very, very... Imagine I got sued by my own friend. Mark Steele is not a anti-vaxxer, the comedian. This is a different Mark Steele with an E on the end. Anyway, just thought I'd clarify that. And yeah, and just before, this has been absolutely brilliant, by the way. The comments we've had have been just absolutely overwhelmingly just so grateful because of your insights and your wisdom. We've been very lucky to have you. Someone at the end just says about, Quint Wolf says about the mainstream media and BBC ignoring comparison with other countries like Vietnam, for example, normalizing how bad the UK government response really is. Absolutely true. In Vietnam had tremendous success, though it is now, I think, a tragic point that needs to be said, that because of the nature of the vaccine being the vaccines being used in richer countries, a very big tragedy is those poorer countries, which have done so often phenomenally well throughout this pandemic, they don't have vaccine protection. Their cases are now going up because the Delta strain is so infectious, and they are now suffering the consequences of the failures of other countries, plus the fact that vaccines are being hoarded in rich countries. I just think that's worth pointing out.
Absolutely, absolutely spot on.
Thank you so much, Professor. You've been, as I've said, absolutely brilliant. Very lucky to have you. A real educational tour de force there. And thank you so much.
Really, well, it's a really great pleasure, and you're doing a great job, Owen. And I really do hope that you feel better and you don't get a dip this afternoon.
Yeah, I felt a bit rougher towards the end, but I'm sure I'll be fine. I'm not going to get a violin out. I'm powering through. But thank you. I'll take it easy. All right. Take care, buddy. Take care.
Okay.
Two brilliant guests. Very, very lucky to have them. Just before I wrap up, there's something I did want to say, actually, and I will probably be grouchy about this. Not grouchy. I deserve to be angry about it. We should be angry about it. I obviously spoke about this last week, and this was about the death of Dawn Foster, who was a brilliant young left-wing journalist, died in her early 30s and after a long illness. And for those of us who've known Dawn, I've known her for a decade, obviously this was an extremely distressing event, and it's been so heartwarming to see so many people online who've been so touched by Dawn's work. She covered so many issues, injustices committed by the government. She spoke truth to power. She didn't take any bullshit. And, you know, the response from people who've been touched by her work, I think, has been really incredible. The reason I am bringing this up, and, you know, some would say there's an argument to ignore it, but I don't agree with that, is that the Times columnist Giles Corran relished in her death. Did two tweets. One basically, the first one saying, like, I hope she burns in hell. The other saying, ha ha ha, kind of thing. Arguing because she'd slighted him and his family, and actually what all she'd done is allude in a very gentle way, actually, on Twitter to the fact that he has a famous father, and the nature of the media industry in terms of people with privileged connections. And that was sufficient for him to relish the death of a young working class female writer who died suddenly after a long illness. It's absolutely disgusting. I don't think I have any words to describe my sheer disgust at this. And it is indicative of something broader. Now, the reason I'll say this is because partly of that, because you might have expected, given a senior Times columnist, it's like one of the flagship columnists of the Times, also does their Times radio station, though to be fair, about three people listen to that, but is, you know, on the he's a BBC presenter. I mean, imagine I'd done that about, I mean, a young woman, maybe she was a centrist or a right-wing columnist, died after, like, I would be correctly hounded out. I'd be sacked like that, by the way, but I'd be hounded out of public life in disgrace, correctly. And I think what's so, for me, repulsive is barely anybody in the media said anything about this. Like, I mean, those of us on the left have, but everybody else, they know, they saw the tweets. His colleagues saw the tweets. Everyone knows about the tweets. They haven't said anything. Someone today in the Times has finally alluded to it and called his tweets misguided. Or no, ill-considered, sorry, ill-considered, I think. Ill-considered, relishing the death of a young woman. Because you were so affronted by her pointing out your privilege. And that's the point I was going to make, actually. Because, look, you know, Dawn was clearly disliked by a lot of people within the mainstream media ecosystem for a few reasons. Firstly, because she got there despite having no connections, no privilege, a working class young woman with all the odds stacked against her, and disproportionately the media is drawn from privileged backgrounds. It's just statistically a fact in terms of the national media. Disproportionate in terms of people, in terms of you can see the number of surnames, famous surnames of columnists with privileged families. That's just a fact. Like, unless you're a social Darwinian, you think, well, actually, the most privileged people are the best. Then obviously you realize that that clearly isn't based on talent, but there is a large degree of privilege at play. Odds stacked in some people's favor from birth, odds stacked against others also from birth, conception, arguably. Now, there's other reasons. She called out the mainstream media for its bullshit. She called out its privilege. She called out its failings. They didn't like that. They don't like it. They hate so many. There are great journalists out there, by the way. Not all journalists, hashtag. Well, come on. I don't think we have to go down that route, do we? But it is the case that we have a media which all too often punches down, demonizes minorities, doesn't hold the powerful to account. Much of the press acts as the partisan wing, PR department, the propaganda wing of the Conservative government. She called all that out. She called out people in the media. She called them out for their often servile nature to the government, including during the pandemic, in which people have needlessly died in their tens of thousands, partly because the media didn't do their job in many cases, exceptions, but in many, many cases. She had other causes she was very passionate about, trans rights, supporting trans rights within the media ecosystem in Britain, where transphobia has become a cult, frankly, frankly, when I see anti-vaxxers and anti-trans activists, they're occasionally an overlap. I've noticed my own mentions. The same people, radicalized online, often vulnerable, but radicalized online, gone down various rabbit holes, parroting the same nonsense. And she stood for trans people and trans rights. That was a rare thing to do in the mainstream media. And they obviously hated for it. So what they've done is they've gone, oh, well, Giles Corbyn has said these terrible things about her because he was so affronted by his own privilege being questioned. And that's the other point. Because do you know what? If it comes to it and actually media, like senior figures in the media industry want to kick off about something, oh, they will. I know that because whenever I have spoken out about the privileged nature of so much of the British media, all about its problems with groupthink and so on, then I get for the next week half the bloody blue ticks. And yes, I am also a blue tick, not a blue tick. Should we go down that route? Half the blue ticks of the British media piling in as though I've essentially gone up to their mothers and told them to go F themselves. That's how angry they get. So they'll get angry when privilege is called out. They'll get angry when the failings of the mainstream media are called out. Furious. But when a Times journalist relishes the death of a young working class journalist because she had the temerity to suggest that his privilege had something to do with his position, nothing, almost nothing, zero, silence. I think the only newspaper that covered it is The National, a pro-independence outlet in Scotland. Because as far as they're concerned, relishing the deaths of, as I've said, a young working class woman who dared to question privilege is the worst. And to the thing about Giles Corran, as others have pointed out, he's not even the most talented Corran in his own family, whilst Dawn Foster had to defy odds which Giles Corran could never even imagine. And I know Giles Corran, classic cry bully, you know, he once deleted his Twitter account because he wrote some gratuitous homophobic stuff about me, where he said I would end up being an old lord chasing after tight-arsed researchers, and then claimed my fans had turned up to his house. Nonsense. And then, oh, I'm the victim. That's what they do. That's what these people do. Cry bullies. I have called it out. And the reason it's important to do this is not just because of Giles Corran, who's a pitiful excuse for a human being, whose behavior online would have ended most of the journalists if they didn't have the odds stacked in his favor and his political opinions. But because of what it says about the media, the silence. Because, as I've said, angrier about privilege being called out than they are about a young working class journalist having her death mocked. Sorry to end on that note. It's been great to have, as I've said, two brilliant, brilliant guests who've been absolutely fantastic. Do, as I've said, those of you support the show, in fact, I need to read out those of you who've been absolutely brilliant in supporting us through Super Chat. That's people watching through YouTube, for those listening to the podcast. John McKenzie, Shane Tomblin, Kieran Buckley, Fridge Freezer, Tarena Amadi Parker, Max Madonna, Attila Desix, Rach AEL, Anne Hayfield, Tadeusz Campwell, a regular, TBC, Fox Glove, another, Quint Wolf, David Boratta, who says Dawn Foster was a hero, and I hope she serves as an inspiration for more young working class folk to become journalists. This country needs more working class journalists. Amen, David. There are far too few people like Dawn. And that the thing is, when we say that was an irreplaceable loss with Dawn, we mean literally an irreplaceable loss, because there's nobody like her left. Carolyn Westlake, in memory of Dawn Foster, we need more strong women like her to fight this patriarchal privilege. Absolutely amen. Her feminism was at the absolute core of who she was. And that legacy must be that we continue to fight and all the causes that she believed in. To support the show, the documentaries we've got planned when I'm not infectious with a deadly illness, do support us on patreon.com/ownjones84. You keep the team doing the amazing job they do, because I obviously don't have the ability to do that. Do press, if you're watching on YouTube, press like and subscribe. If you're on the podcast, then do give us 5 stars if you like the show, please, and subscribe. I'm now going to go and take myself. I might go and watch some. I'm going to finish watching Mae Martin's the brilliant, brilliant Netflix comedy show, Feel Good. If you haven't watched it, do watch it. That's how I'm going to get a nice cup of tea and lunch and watch that. And hopefully feel, as I've said, thanks to our vaccination program, I'm sure I would be, my risk of being iller than I am is much lower. And even though I feel rough, it could be a lot worse. Do go and get your shots if you haven't, everybody. That's what's going to get us out of this nightmare in large part. Cheers, everyone. Lots of love. We've got loads of interviews this week to come, including how Hollywood and the Pentagon have directly collaborated. This is a really fascinating video. Really looking forward to do that. We'll have our documentary soon. Thanks for your support on Patreon on Who Owns Britain, which is going to be a really interesting documentary. But we'll be back live next Sunday at 12 o'clock, where I will be less brain foggy, hopefully, but still in self-isolation. Lots of love, everybody. Take care of yourself, and I will see you then.
Thanks for listening, everyone. I hope you got a lot out of that. I certainly did. Do support us on patreon.com/ownjones84. Help us decide which documentaries we do, who we speak to, that kind of thing. Or use the support function to keep the team doing their amazing work. I will speak to you soon. Take care. Lots of love.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.